Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I sat down to talk with Monica Tukey. Monica and I met a few years ago in Beijing, China, and she has since moved on to greener pastures in South Korea. I recently took a trip to her home in Seoul, where we got caught up on old times. We talked about her unique upbringing in two separate worlds in both Mississippi and in Singapore. And we discussed her young adulthood, where she spent a few years living on a small island in the South Pacific. There's a lot of great stories coming up in this episode, so let's get right to it and welcome Monica Tukey. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. I am in South Korea right now, in Seoul, and I think I'll talk a minute or so about how I got here. I left from Beijing with my wife Katie and with a bunch of friends, and we went up to Panjin. It's a smaller city of like a million people in China. That's might as well be a small town. And it's kind of right on the ocean, and there's this special alkaline type of vegetation that grows there, and it's green for most of the year, but for about a month or two in the fall, it turns red, and it's really beautiful. There's some really great contrast as well with all of the white storks that live there. So we checked out that area for a couple of days. Then I broke off from the group. I took a train down to Dalian, which is a bigger city, like 3 million or so people on the coast. I had a pretty horrible night there. I don't want to go into great detail, but I ended up sleeping on the cold, hard concrete of a parking lot. And then I jumped on a ferry down to Yantai, and that was really cool, going across this big harbor, and then down to Qingdao in China also. And then I hopped on another ferry, this time across the Great Ocean, out to South Korea, and I ended up in Seoul. And while I'm in Seoul, I'm staying with an old friend, Monica Tukey, and I have her here tonight. And hey, Monica.
Hi.
Thanks for hosting Katie and me, and also thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And so it's for me, it's my first time in South Korea, and for Katie, it's her second, but it's her first time on the main part of South Korea. She's only been to Jeju. It's been an awesome time so far, and we're looking forward to going to a national park tomorrow and heading down to the south part of the country in a couple of days, and we'll just be here for about a week or so. It's a Chinese holiday right now, so we're actually trying to get away from China because, you know, a billion people or so are traveling this week. We used to live in the same spot together, right, Monica? And Biba Bay and
yes.
good old Beijing.
Good old Beijing, yeah.
Yeah, and so... how's your time going here? Your new transplant to South Korea?
I'm here with my daughter, and we're enjoying Seoul. There's so much to do, and it's very different from Beijing. It has a different feel to it. There's a hum of activity, but there's also a laid-backness to it that makes it a very pleasant place to live.
Yeah, it seems like it's more developed than China, is my first impression. The traffic is different, like cars actually stop for you here.
Yes, and they stay in their own lane.
Yeah, yeah, there's not really surprises. They kind of drive the way Americans drive, mm-hmm. I think. It's very similar.
Yes.
Whereas China's just totally a completely different system.
Yes.
Yeah, and yeah, that's good. Although, people stop for crosswalks, pedestrians do.
Yes, very much so. It's... I've seen no traffic anywhere and the light red and a whole group of people standing there waiting for the light to turn green for them to cross the road, yeah, rather than jaywalking.
Yeah, I was amazed by that. Like, I'm looking and there's like, I look left, I can see like four blocks. There's not one car. Then look right, four more blocks. Mm-hmm. Like, why aren't you guys crossing? And,
yeah.
But then I started to worry I'd get like a ticket or something.
I've crossed a couple of times in that situation and feel guilty about it because they still stay on the sidewalk and they wait for the light to turn green.
Yeah, I think I did that once today and everyone else just stayed there and was like, who's this crazy foreigner?
Yes. Better safe than sorry, I guess.
Right. But in China, that's just completely normal, and like you just have to sometimes.
You'd never cross the street if you waited for cars to stop for you.
Oh, no way. You just have to get in front of them.
Mm-hmm. And then run.
And run, yeah. Yeah, well, that's kind of fun, though. I don't know. It's scary, but it's like, there's good and bad things, you know? It's just like so much faster to just run across a busy street than to wait for this light to turn, especially when there's not like a street that you're on, when there's like a red light, but it's only for the crosswalk. Those things can take like 5 minutes before they turn green.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So, yeah, that's definitely a downside. But anyway, it's been really good here, and I take it you're enjoying it.
I am. We're happy here. We've made friends, and we're learning the community, and I'm taking language classes so that I can communicate in the stores and become functionally literate in the language, and it'll take a while, but
it's such a worthwhile
process.
Right, with any language, it's just hard. Languages are hard. Do you speak anything else?
I speak the Ikiribes language just functionally, just enough to get by.
Okay.
I was there in the Peace Corps after university, and my ex-husband is an Ikiribes man, and he moved with me to the States after I was there for 3 years.
Okay. Do you want to explain to people where Kiribati is? I don't think it's a very well-known country.
No, it's in Micronesia, and it's in the middle of the Pacific. It's about a four-hour flight to Fiji. It's a 30-minute flight to Majuro, the Marshall Islands, where there's an American base. And around it, there's Tonga and Tuvalu and Nauru and all these other little island countries.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard of Tuvalu. I haven't heard of most of those others. Micronesia. Is Micronesia just the term for all of those countries?
Yes, for that area in the Pacific where the islands are located.
Okay. How many people live in Kiribati, do you know?
When I was there, it was around 60,000 people, but now I believe that's almost doubled.
Okay.
The number of people. Because of the climate change and the water issues, they're actually leaving and going to Fiji and New Zealand, and those countries are welcoming people in.
Yeah, I remember seeing this, like, I don't know if he was a mayor or something of a, I don't even remember which country, but one of these small island nations, and he said, look, the highest point on my island is 2 meters above sea level, and after that, you just got a coconut tree. That's like, that's all, that's as high as you can go.
Yeah.
What are we going to do?
Because the Kiribati Islands are coral atolls rather than volcanic islands, they're pretty flat.
Yeah.
And there's no hilly area, and there's no rich dirt to plant things in. So mostly it's coconut and some papaya and some breadfruit. Hmm. And they get a lot of imported things like rice and canned meat from other islands around it. And they've partnered up very closely with Australia. And New Zealand comes around and helps out too. So I guess that's why a lot of them are transplanting themselves in New Zealand.
Okay. Yeah, it's so sad to see this happening. How bad is it? Is it just a couple of islands have already been flooded, or are they just expecting this to happen?
They're losing land, but they're not flooded over yet. But the ocean is shifting and it's coming in areas. Now, I don't know if most of the islands are shaped kind of like a C. And you have the ocean side. Yes, the letter C. And you have the ocean side and you have the lagoon side. And so the ocean side is encroaching, as far as I know. And the last I've heard, that there's still land there, but the water's just creeping in on the ocean side.
Okay. So they're just proactively getting out of there. Mm. But the population has doubled. Is that just like the natural way of doubling the population, or is that immigration?
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I assume it's just babies.
Just many, many babies.
Yeah, just happy people.
I guess there's not a whole lot to do on Kiribati.
Nope.
Yeah.
Fishing, and they're a little bit more advanced now from what I hear from my former sister-in-laws than they were when I was there. They have cell phones called the Coconut Wireless, and I believe they even have a television station. When I was there, they just had radio, and the radio turned on probably at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 5 o'clock. I don't remember exactly. It's been a while. But they just had radio for entertainment.
And they had electricity?
The main island had electricity, but the outer islands, not so much. The island that I was on didn't have electricity the first year I was there. The second year I was there, they put electricity in Government Village, and that's the homes that they provided for government workers. And we had one fluorescent light in the middle of the house, and it turned on at 6 and turned off at 10.
Okay. Yeah, I've been in a lot of villages like that, actually, in Bolivia especially, but Peru too, where they just get electricity for a couple hours when it gets dark.
Yeah.
Well, between when it gets dark and when they typically
when
they go to bed.
When they need it most to do what they need to do.
Yeah, so it's enough to, like, run a light bulb or two. And
hold the mosquitoes at bay.
Ah, okay.
Because when the lights went out, it was like, the feast happened. A lot of mosquitoes would come in, and you'd have to get in your mosquito net, or you would be pretty much eaten alive. Yes, that bad. But they didn't like the fluorescent light, and they...
So they stayed away from lights?
Yes, they stayed away from the fluorescent light.
Huh, somehow I had this picture in my mind that mosquitoes would always go toward lights. No.
No. Not those mosquitoes. I don't know why. Maybe they were vampire mosquitoes.
Yeah, I guess so. You had some, like, really interesting stories you were telling me the other day about just getting an idea of how remote these islands are. Like, the island nation itself is really remote. And then you were on, like, a remote part of this remote island nation.
Yes. When we flew there as Peace Corps volunteers, we had to stop overnight in Fiji. There weren't any direct flights.
So you went, what, like, L.A. or something to...
San Francisco to Hong Kong.
Oh, all the way to Hong Kong, then back.
Let me think.
Oh, it's been a while, I guess.
Yes, it's been many years.
Huh.
We went San Francisco, Fiji. San Francisco to Fiji. Stayed overnight. San Francisco, Honolulu, Fiji.
Okay, that makes sense. Yep.
San Francisco, Honolulu, Fiji, and then Kiribati. And we had to overnight. We actually had to stay 2 days in Fiji.
Why is that?
Because there wasn't a flight.
Oh, there's not daily flights.
Yes. Okay. No, I think there was a flight every Monday that came internationally.
Yeah.
And then there would be like a Wednesday flight to Majuro. There were a few international flights that came in, but it was maybe a once or twice a week type of thing. It wasn't very common.
Huh.
For flights to come in. They didn't have that many people coming or going.
Well,
so
yeah, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't financially needed.
Did that flight just get you to the main island of Kiribati?
Yes.
And then what did you do to get to your island?
There were a fleet of planes. They had three planes when I was there. They had the Casa, which seated about 33. Then they had another plane that seated about 12, maybe. And then they had a small plane that would seat 4, around 4. They might could pack 6 in there if they really needed to. But the Casa, the big plane, was quite interesting. When it would fly and it would rain would drip between the cockpit and the cabin. And so we would watch rain and hope it stayed together.
Get out the duct tape.
Get out the duct tape. And actually, if I had duct tape, I'd use it to wrap around the pig to make the pig be quiet that was sitting on one side and the chicken on the other side. Yeah.
Shut them up?
Yes, to get them quiet because they were not happy about flying. And the plane was not insulated, so the engines were incredibly loud. So maybe I would have just taken the duct tape and covered up my ears.
Okay. Yeah. So the third choice, if you had duct tape, after duct taping the pig, duct taping your ears.
Chicken would be me.
Then yes. Duct tape. Yeah, and then maybe duct tape the plane to keep that thing aloft.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Noisy.
And now you're telling me you didn't always have to take the plane, though, right? Like, you took boats in?
Yes. The plane would fly to the island, from the main island to the island of Tamana that I was on. It would fly once every 2 weeks. And that's how we would get mail. And then if the planes were broken or couldn't fly, which happened frequently,
I imagine.
The cargo ship would come every 3 or so months. So if I needed to get back to the island, that was an option too. If it just so happened that I needed to go around the time.
Okay.
So cargo ships would come 3 months and planes would come every 2 weeks when everything was working the way it was supposed to.
So the vast majority of their supplies were only on these cargo ships.
Then. Yes.
So they had to last for 3 months.
Yes. But they never, ever hurt for food because they had the ocean.
Yeah.
And they would fish. And when it was rainy season and the water was high and dangerous and they couldn't go out fishing in the deeper waters, they would just catch reef fish.
Okay.
They would wait for low tide and they would go out and they would catch reef fish. And there was always breadfruit on the island. There's 13 varieties of breadfruit. You have breadfruit that tastes like potatoes, and they were really starchy. And then you have breadfruit that tastes like bananas, and that's very sweet. And they would use breadfruit to make soup. They would chop it up and fry it, and it tasted like potato chips. So they had it was hard to get tired of breadfruit because there were so many different varieties, and each one tasted a little bit different, and they were fixed. They were cooked in different ways.
And this was just growing everywhere?
Yes.
Oh. Well, I guess, like, people lived here centuries ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And without rice, without this 3 month thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they have some way of getting by.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
There was a government-run garden that was across the street from my house. I lived in Government Station because I lived on the school compound with the other teachers. So the government garden, I was craving something different one day, and I watched this fig, and it was one solitary fig. I watched this fig grow on this limb of a fig tree, and you really couldn't call it a fig tree because it was just skinny and winding and long, and it wasn't big enough to have a root, but it was like maybe 30 feet long, and it just like looked like one little limb that just kept winding around the garden. And I watched this fig grow, and my mama had figs on her tree. She would always make fig preserves, and she had this big, huge, massive tree and would have hundreds of figs on it, and I never liked them. And I never wanted to eat them. But when you're away from home and when you've eaten breadfruit and fish as much as you can, and you see something that, one, reminds you of home, and two, is going to offer you a different flavor, it makes you want it. So I watched this fig grow and get plump and fat. And when it looked like it was really big, I got one of my fellow teachers on the island. She was a local lady. Her name was Maddie. I got her to go with me into the garden, and I said, I want to get that fig. And she says, okay, I'll help you. And it was on a part of that winding limb that was really high. So she gets a long stick, and she goes, and she tries to get the stick on top near it so that she can pull down that vine. And just as she hooked the vine, this big rat came running up that limb. He had the same idea I had, and I was determined to get that fig. So I run closer, and I start jumping up, and she gets the limb down just enough for me to grab a hold of that fig. And right as I get my fingers on that fig, the rat gets as close to it as can be. And then I pull the fig down, and she lets that limb, that stick go, and that limb and that rat went flying off in the other direction. And I did a happy dance, and I looked at that fig, and I didn't even wash it. I stuffed it right in my mouth and ate every bit of it, and it was the best fig I have ever had.
Wow. That's a great story. The things you that you go through in these places, huh?
Yes. I kept a diary of every day that I was there. And food was such an important part. My family's Italian, and we love to eat. And so when I would get really homesick or crave something, I would open my diary and I would just write. And years later, I was rereading my diary, and I realized that at one point I wrote 3 pages filled with food I want to eat when I get back home.
Wow.
Just one item after another, after another, and after another. Just filled it up thinking about food from home. But I was okay with not having it as long as I could think, okay, I'll get it when I get home.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Ernest Shackleton. I don't know if you know him. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's the great. I'll give you the rundown later. But it's the greatest story ever that he was trapped in the Antarctic and for years with his crew. And I remember reading about his whole crew. You know, they hadn't seen another human being in like 2 years, and they were living off of just seals, the blubber. And they had this long conversation about what they would eat when they finally got back to land, if they ever got back. And most of them wanted like desserts, you know, and sweet things.
Yeah.
But a few of them wanted a steak. It's like most of these guys, you know, they were constipated. They had no fiber in their diets.
Yeah.
It must have been pretty rough. But some of them still wanted a steak. Like, wow, you really like meat. Okay.
It's the flavor of home that you want, that comfort food. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the nutritional benefits. It's that taste of home.
Hmm. Oh, so where's home for you?
Mississippi. Kind of.
Kind of. Well, I can tell a little bit from your accent. You just got a little bit of that twang.
A slight southern accent.
Not extreme. But you said a few things already in this podcast. Like I think you said Mike could or something like that. Like, oh yeah, that's a southern thing.
Yeah.
And your mama.
Yeah, mama.
Yeah. So what do you mean when you say a kind of Mississippi?
Well, when I was 6 months old, my parents moved to Singapore, the Republic of Singapore in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
And my dad worked for an oil company, and that's pretty much where I was raised. We moved permanently back to the States when I was 16. Hmm. But most summers we would go home to Mississippi, and my parents were born and raised in southern Mississippi, and near the Mississippi Gulf Coast in the Biloxi-D'Iberville area. Hmm. So it's a conflicted. I would be a country girl in the summer and then a city girl.
Yeah, very different worlds.
During the school year, yeah. But it was like the best of both worlds, because I could have fun doing things in the woods and then go back to the city and have the metropolitan life and the culture of going to musicals and
I bet.
Seeing the world.
Yeah, that must have given you a unique perspective.
Huh. Very much so.
What was life like in Singapore?
Life was wonderful.
Yeah?
My dad thinks I have rose-colored glasses when I think back of Singapore, but it really was the perfect childhood. Hmm. Being with children from all over the world in an international school and learning different languages as a child. My parents told me that I spoke in multiple languages because all the kids in the neighborhood, we would play together. Uh-huh. And we would learn each other's languages as we were talking together and playing together. Yeah. And I would come home and speak to them, and it wouldn't make sense to them. But when you don't stay in those languages, you lose them all.
Yeah, sure.
But being able to communicate with those other kids so naturally was an interesting experience. But as an older child in Singapore in my teenage years, the country is so incredibly safe that I would have free run of the island. I would tell my parents where I was going and then head off. And I did that at even a young age, could go and venture off with my friends and go find fun things to do in the island. And
yeah, no problem, huh?
There wasn't any fear that I would get hurt or lost or
yeah,
anything.
Seems like that here, too. Seoul seems incredibly safe.
Very safe.
Like, my first experience here, I got off the boat because I took the ferry from China. I was just getting on the subway, and I guess I just didn't understand how the ticket thing worked, because it was supposed to give me 2,000 won for change. And just as it was, like, this was happening, this old lady kind of came up to me and started talking to me and asking me where I was from and stuff. And I didn't want to be rude, and I kind of got distracted, and this machine just started beeping at me, and I was like, I don't know, I've been in this country for 5 minutes, I don't know how it works.
You already broke something.
Yeah, I must have broken something, and then I thought, oh, I got scammed, it's the old lady scam, so she stole something, or somebody. I'm like, wait, what? So I'm so confused, and so I started patting my pockets, and like, no, I have everything. And then I remember, like, oh, I'm supposed to get, like, 2,000 won for change, and I don't know where that is. And I was like, whatever, forget it. It's like, $2. It's not much money. And I just walked away. And just a couple minutes later, this employee of the train station came running up to me. He's like, sir, your money. You forgot your money. And he handed me my 2,000 won. I'm like, wow, that's some honesty. That's pretty extreme. And so it was a really good impression for first coming here.
Yeah. When I I had interviewed with a man for a job here years ago. And he told me that he left his wallet on the subway by accident. Mm. And he asked lost and found, and they had it with everything in it. Mm. And it's not often that, you know, a wallet could be left on a subway and all of the money still be there and the wallet be turned into lost and found.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
My daughter and I have never felt scared here, uncomfortable here. Yeah. And my daughter walks around at night. She's 16, so she's not young. She's not so young that she can't do that, but she'll go out with her friends and she'll walk down the hill by herself and come home at night, and I don't fear for her safety, and she's comfortable doing it as well. And I would think twice about letting her do that in the States or in other places.
Yeah.
Walk around a city by herself.
Yeah. Although, I will say, I remember, like, I think I was 16. I had this experience kind of similar to what we were just talking about. Let me see if I can remember this. I went downhill skiing one night, and I don't know, I was just some dumb kid. And I had just cashed my paycheck because I used to work at McDonald's. And I got like $200 and for 2 weeks of work. And that was like all the money I had. And I like just put my wallet in my pocket. And it must have fallen out somewhere at the ski hill. And this is before the internet. It was kind of like there wasn't really anything I could do. I got home and I realized I didn't have my wallet. So I just thought, well, you just never know. I'll just drive out there. And it was like a 1 hour drive. But it was 2 weeks worth of money was in my wallet. It was a lot of money for me at the time. And so I just drove out to the ski hill and asked, and they said, what does it look like? And I described it, and sure enough, there it was. And I opened it. I thought, well, maybe I'll just get my driver's license back, 'cause I'd hate to lose that. And the money will all be gone for sure. And then I opened it and all the money was still there. And I was like, oh my God, someone just turned this wallet in and like didn't take a dollar out.
A good Samaritan.
Yeah, yeah. So they do exist. Or at least they used to 20 years ago.
Yeah.
No, I think they still do.
But they do.
Yeah. But that really stuck with me for a long time. And I just trust people like a lot. And things usually work out fine.
I do too, usually. Hmm. But as a mother, mm-hmm. and a mother of a daughter, I'm way more cautious with my child than I am with me. And when I was in the States with my daughter, there were things that I wouldn't do with her that I would do by myself. Like if somebody was on the side of the road, I myself might stop and help if it's a gentleman. But with my daughters with me, I wouldn't.
No.
No.
Well, that's understandable.
I just, yeah, she's my first priority for safety. And yeah. I have a son as well, and he's 20, and if he were with me, then I would have a better chance of stopping than I would if it was just my daughter and I.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that he could protect us, but just having another person, you know, power in numbers.
Yeah, well, I've met him before, and he's a pretty big presence, you know, he's kind of...
Now he is. He wasn't always.
No. You know, he's the kind of guy who he gives off that impression, like, don't mess with me, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's good to have. Huh, so let's see. Let's talk about some other places you've been. How long did you spend in China?
I was in Beijing for 2 years.
Yeah, how'd that go?
It was interesting.
That's not all that good.
Well, there was a lot of positives about China. The people are very kind and considerate one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
And...
You mean the local people?
Yes.
Yeah.
The local Chinese people were very kind and considerate one-on-one, and they were very gracious when I attempted the language or when I tried to do new things. They were fairly friendly and helping me out. The pollution was a big issue.
Yeah, that's definitely a big downside. And it seems like every time I record one of these podcasts, we always end up talking about the pollution. Yeah, because it's just something that it's right there.
Yeah,
you just look out the window and you can see it's a bad day or it's a good day.
Yes. Not only in your face, but in your lungs, yeah.
Right, right. And it can affect your health. And, yeah, it's just all around bad when there's pollution. But yes. It's not every day that it's that bad. It can still be just totally clear in Beijing, too.
Yes.
Many, many good days as well.
We had some beautiful blue sky, white puffy cloud days my last year there in the spring. And in the fall. I think winter time, of course, it's harder. But they understand the pollution issue, too. And the students that I taught there, it was a concern for them.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully those kids will grow up to try to make differences, make changes.
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, the government has already taken a lot of steps to reduce the levels, and you know, it's very easy to just say pollution's bad, this is bad, but it comes with a big positive benefit too, and all of the tremendous economic activity that's happened and the growth that's happened in China. I mean, if you go to China today, it's incredible. There's a giant middle class there. There's a lot of wealthy people. It must look. I mean, I never went there 20 years ago, but it must look like a completely different place.
The growth is amazing.
It's, yeah.
How fast things are put up and put together. It's interesting to watch the change in the city. Things changed a lot over just the course of the 2 years we were there. We lived in a suburban area that didn't have much around us other than a few other little housing areas, and by the time we left, they had built this massive mall with shops and a grocery store and a movie theater, providing more places for foreigners that lived and worked in the area to hang out, and building the economy up in that area.
Yeah, and like the shops that are in the mall are like, they could be in any shopping mall, right, in America.
Yes. I mean, Gap and Uniqlo and...
Yeah, it goes on and on. All the restaurants, there's Papa John's, and there's not just McDonald's and Burger King. There's like Baskin Robbins, and
yes, and Dunkin' Donuts, which caused quite a stir at our school. They were quite happy to have Dunkin' Donuts down the road.
Just going crazy for these donuts, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, there's definitely like a lot of these shopping malls in Beijing that are just incredible. They're just so nice. It's really interesting. And then once you leave the city, things get a little more rustic, shall we say?
Yes. Like, yes.
Yeah, there aren't so many of those big malls outside of the giant cities. But still, it's really cool to watch this change happening before our eyes and just kind of catching the tail end of it, I think, of this migration from the countryside into cities. Just And like, the numbers are all so mind-boggling, too. Like, I think the middle class in China now is, like, 600 million people.
So it's, and growing.
And growing. Growing very fast. Like, double the size of the United States.
It's yeah, just, they're very savvy businessmen and women. And they're very hard workers. The parents of my students would be on business trips often, and they kept crazy hours and left before the kids came to school and came home when the kids were already in bed. So they made a lot of sacrifices to advance their nation and the businesses and their financial status in the world. And education was incredibly important so that their children can have opportunities. A lot of my parents wanted their kids to go to American boarding schools to learn language so that they can be active in world economy, not just in the Chinese economy.
Yeah, that's great. And you say kids, but really, for most of them, it's just one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the government did end their one-child policy just last year, but obviously there hasn't been enough time for that to change much.
Yes, but in my class last year, my class of fifth graders, seven of them had siblings.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a large number.
It is a large number, but there was a big age gap between the siblings.
Oh, okay.
So they would have very young siblings.
Yeah.
Some of them infant siblings, some of them just in preschool.
Mm. Yeah, I tutor this kid most nights in Beijing, and the first time he said, oh, I have to go see my brother, the guy that I tutor is probably like 14 or 15, and he said something about his brother, and I mean, I thought it was going to be, well, what would you think, maybe a 12-year-old, maybe a 16-year-old, somewhere in that range, and then I heard a baby crying in the background. I'm like, that's your little brother? Like, yeah. And I think that's slightly more common in China than it would be in our country.
I believe there is an age range. You can have a second child, but you had to wait a certain number of years before you
did. Is that right? I never heard about that. Oh, okay.
I'm not sure how many years it is. Maybe seven? I'm not sure. But, yeah, so a group of my kids had siblings. Had younger siblings, but they were much younger. But because they could have children and just pay taxes, some of them just had children and had to pay.
Yeah, pay
the
a fine
tax.
For it.
Yes, pay the tax for it. They just couldn't work in the government.
Oh, okay.
One Chinese man that I had, he was the father of one of my students. He was really funny. He said that the government didn't want him to have children, and he had four. So he has four kids. And he said he couldn't work for the government and have four kids. That's okay. He had his own business. Mm. He ran a farm. And so his four children, he had two of them in American University, and the other two were in school at our school. And he just was determined to give his kids a good opportunity. But then he wanted a bigger family, and so he just did it and paid the fine and kept his business going.
Dealt with it as best he could.
And he had a funny sense of humor about it. He just laughed and said, I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yeah, it's super interesting living in China because just so many things are different. And like here, or like if I meet a Westerner, what does the conversation go like? Well, what's your name? Where are you from? And early on, you usually ask, do you have any brothers or sisters? And it's just something you ask. But in China, I've just learned, early on, I learned, like, you just don't ask. Because it's probably no.
Yes.
And it'd be kind of, the default is no, actually. And probably most, you know, it'd be kind of weird if they did. But, like you're saying, seven of your kids had them. So maybe I didn't think that through enough. Maybe I need to change my mind on that again.
But maybe these kids and their family are different because they're going to international school. So they're they're more financially able to have the more children.
Well, it is quite an expensive school. So
my sister-in-law is also, she's Chinese and she's from China. She went to school in Canada, I believe, university in Canada, and her father's a doctor. And her mother's a professional as well, but she's an only child.
Okay.
She doesn't have any brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
But she lives in Mississippi, and she has a new baby.
Oh, okay.
With my brother.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. But at any rate, yeah, Katie and I moved to China at the same time that you did. And I don't know exactly how long we'll be there, but I can definitely say that I'm going to miss it once I leave. I mean, even now, I've just been away for like a week and I'm thinking about China. And I'm not like in some boring place. I'm in one of the biggest cities in the world. It's almost like one of those inevitable things when you go somewhere, you compare it to what you know to this place that you're in. And it's something that I try not to do, but I can't help it. You know, comparing the food, like, what is the Korean food compared with Chinese food? And, you know, and the language and the way people act. And
yeah, that's human nature.
I guess
that's part of our learning process. Mm-hmm. How our brain is pulling in information, you're making comparisons to file that information that you know.
Yeah, right.
It makes the new information that you're processing more memorable.
Is that right? Yeah, I guess it makes sense. Huh. So I guess I should keep comparing.
Of course.
Compare away. All right.
Of course. The problem is if there's a negative.
Yeah.
You know, oh, my place is better, but of course you're not like that. You're open-minded so that you...
Yeah, it's just good and bad about everything, everywhere you go.
Yeah. There are things I miss about China. I miss some of the foods and some of the places, and even when you go to a new place and it's challenging and it's hard, once you start learning things and get comfortable, and then you go to a new place, you start all over.
Yeah.
It's like you're a baby again, and you can't speak the language, and you can't get what you need, and those growing pains.
Yeah, it sure seemed like that for me when I moved to China at first. It was like, I can't read anything, I can't say anything, this is really frustrating.
But it's nice once you find your triangle of activity, the places that you normally go and move around in, and then once that becomes comfortable, you can stretch your triangle out a little bit more.
Yeah.
And go to further places, but learning that first little triangle is challenging, but once you get it, you feel confident.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I remember you telling me you used to live here, is that right? In Seoul, like a long time ago?
I didn't live here, but I came here on a high school trip.
Oh, you just came here once. Okay.
When I was in Singapore in high school, we would take interim semester trips. People went out all over the place, and this was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And a group went to China, and I chose to come to South Korea.
Okay.
And so there was probably a group of about 15 of us. We were here for almost 2 weeks or so. We started here in Seoul, went all the way down to Busan, and then came back up. We went by tour bus.
Oh, all right.
And we stopped at different places along the way.
Huh. And what was it like back then? Like different than now?
Very different.
Yeah?
Seoul was a city with buildings, but the buildings weren't as big as they are now, and it wasn't as crowded.
Okay.
But it did have that city feel to it. And it snowed almost the whole time we were here. We came in February.
Wow.
And it was cold and snowy. And when we went down south, it was a little bit warmer, but it was still very cold at that time.
Hmm. I guess that's going to throw off your perception anyway, because you're here during a hot time now.
Yes. And
it's maybe just getting into fall weather.
Yes. Yeah.
Finally cooling off a little bit. Hmm.
It has definitely changed more, and there's more touristy things, because we went from little traditional villages to museums, and I don't remember ever seeing anything that felt touristy.
Huh.
It was like a lot of museums and a lot of little villages and towns along the way.
Hmm. Yeah, well, we went to the Korean War Museum yesterday. Right? Yesterday, yeah.
Yes, that was quite fascinating.
Yeah, that was a great museum. I mean, it was a rainy day, so it was perfect for it. And the whole museum was about war.
Yes, it was.
From ancient times up until the more recent Korean War.
A big part of it was the Korean War.
Yeah, I'd say probably half of the museum was just the Korean War. But yeah, very interesting.
It was fascinating to find out how many different countries were involved in that. It wasn't just you know, just a few countries, it was a lot.
Right. No, I didn't know that at all. And some countries didn't contribute a lot of people, but like Luxembourg. Yeah. Oh, what countries was that? Bolivia, I think, and Brazil. They basically just said,
offered a statement of support.
Yeah, we'll support you. And that's all they did.
In writing.
Yeah.
From here.
Right. And nothing else.
But other countries, even small countries, would send rice and supplies and...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice to see how countries were reaching out and helping their neighbors.
Really amazing.
I was fascinated by the UN part of the exhibit.
Mm. Yeah, I guess it was... The whole UN was involved. And at the end, I remember seeing China. There was a little bit about China there, too. How the South Korean military found some... Chinese soldiers' bones and sent them back to China and did a bunch of testing, like DNA testing and that kind of thing, to verify that it was this soldier. So they repatriated the remains.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so they went through a lot of trouble to do this. And so the Chinese...
To be respectful.
And so, because for those who don't know the war that well, like China fought on the other side. And now the two countries are friendly and... So, more or less. So they,
yes.
Yeah. So, they sent the bones back. And that was nice. That was really good to see.
There is that nice level of respect for ancestors in human life.
Yeah, sure. It's, I guess, less controversial since they've been dead for 60 years.
Yeah. You know? Well, one of the things I found interesting was if a husband died in the war and was buried here... in South Korea, and the wife passed away many years later, they would allow her to be buried beside her husband here in South Korea. So that was nice that they could be interred together.
Yeah, I just thought of something. This has nothing to do with our conversation, but the oldest man in the world just got his bar mitzvah.
Why didn't he have it when he was, 13 or 12?
Well, they gave a good reason for it. World War I was happening.
Oh.
Yeah. He was born in 1903, and when he was 13, it was 1916, and it was right in the middle of the war. And I guess he just never got around to it. It is such a tragic story, too. His wife died in a concentration camp, and I guess he'll rejoin her at some point soon, but... Yeah, he just got a bar mitzvah.
Aww.
Yeah, really cool to see that.
That is funny. That's good. That's good that he was allowed.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of like, I'm really into longevity and looking these things up. And there's one person left who was born in the 1800s. Only one. I think she's Italian. Yeah, so it won't be too much longer. You'll probably see a blurb in the news. Not that I'm looking forward to that.
But. Right.
You know, when there's only one, it's not going to last too much longer.
No. My mother's side of the family, they live a long time.
Yeah?
My grandmother was 101.
Wow, yeah.
She was a couple of months shy of being 101 when she passed away. And that was my great-grandmother. And my grandmother now, she's in her 90s. Mm. And she's doing okay.
Yeah, in her 90s.
She has macular degeneration, so she's going blind, but she still lives by herself and is determined to take care of herself and do what she needs to do. She has her daughters come and help her out some, but she's still independent.
Well, that's great to hear. Yeah, I find it fascinating how some people, when they get to be that age, they are still totally... independent.
Yes.
And others aren't. And it's just really interesting to see, like, I don't know if there's an answer exactly. Partly genetics, partly lifestyle, whatever.
Yeah.
I read this whole book about the last surviving veterans of World War I, for American veterans. And that was really interesting too. This guy he went around and there was this French list that the French government in like 1998, I think, or 97 came up with, or they did this program where they said, if you're an American and you fought on French soil in World War I, and you're still alive, we'll give you a special medal.
Huh.
And so there were, I don't know, at the time probably a few thousand still alive. And so they all got their medals. And a couple of years after that, this guy just started making phone calls and seeing how many of them were left. And he just interviewed as many as possible for his book. And then he waited until they all had died to publish the book. I guess he just didn't want it to be
I don't know. So he collected their stories.
Yeah, and some of them had really good stories. I mean, a lot of them were really sharp. Their minds were still sharp at age 110.
Goodness.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And probably living through things like that, those images and those experiences stick with you.
Yeah, for sure.
I want to be a cantankerous old lady.
Yeah. Keep working on that.
Yeah, well, I think I tend to be very polite. Mm. And I tend to just be kind to those around me. And sometimes don't say what I think. And I think it'd be fun to be old and just to say whatever I want to say.
Yeah, just say anything.
Just,
I don't know.
Let it fly. Whatever pops into my head.
I think once
not in a mean way, but in a cantankerous
way. Yeah. I got it. I hear it. I think when I get really old, I'm going to start like smoking cigarettes and shooting heroin.
Why not?
Yeah, like who cares?
It's so close to the end anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm kind of already a grouchy old man though, and I'm kind of proud of that. Like I love complaining about things. So.
But not the things that matter. Just funny things.
Yeah, hopefully just funny things.
Yeah. My ex-husband's grandfather was a cantankerous old man, and he's a Ikitibus native.
Yeah.
And when he would get mad at anybody, his legs didn't work so much when he got older. Mm. And he would sit cross-legged on a mat. And they don't have grass around their houses. They use coral so that they don't get dirt in their homes.
Yeah, okay.
And they usually keep a basin of water so they wash their feet, but then the coral keeps the sand away. And so he would be sitting on the coral outside his house, and if any of the grandkids did anything that he didn't like or teased him, he would spit at them. And if the spit didn't make it, it would make him mad, so then he would pick up the pieces of coral and just throw it at him, yelling curses at the same time.
Wow.
But Tuabo, my ex-husband, said that's when it's a fond memory of his. Yeah, because then they would do things on purpose just to see him get worked up and mad. And
see how far he can
spit.
Yell,
yes, and throw things and... And he laughed, and he said he got that twinkle in his eye when he would get mad. So it's like, you know, that spark of life is still there, even though his legs weren't working. And
yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of sitting around on the islands, like sitting around outside your house? Is that a pretty common thing?
Yes.
Island life?
Yep. They would they would weave mats out of the rib of the coconut palm, and they would lay them out either on the coral or on buoyas. Those are the porch-like homes without walls.
Hmm.
They had roofs on them, and they would be up off the ground, and that's where families would meet and play games and eat dinners. And they would sit up there on those buoyas or on the mats on the ground and spend hours playing card games and talking and singing together. And
people of all ages?
People of all ages.
Wow, so they're very wealthy on free time.
Yes.
Yeah, those kind of cultures are so interesting. How they have so much time. Were they happy?
Very. Happy people. Yeah. Very. Well, when you have coconuts and breadfruit and fish from the ocean and you do your work hard in the day, then you've got the evenings to sit around and spend time with family and friends.
Yeah.
Very social culture.
Sure.
People didn't go into their homes and closed doors. People's doors were always open. And
yeah.
Everybody was always outside, and when I would ride my bike through the village, everybody would be outside, and they would be friendly, and they would call out and wave me over, and I'd have to stop and have tea. And
Everybody knew who you were.
Yes. There were 1,000 natives on my island and me.
You're the only foreigner?
I was the only foreigner.
Whoa, did anyone else speak English?
The government worker spoke English, and the teacher spoke English.
And they were Kiribati natives?
Yep.
Okay. And you didn't speak their language? Or you spoke a little bit?
Well, when you go into the Peace Corps, they'll spend about 3 months training you. And part of the training is a little bit of the language. But I wasn't a very good student in learning the language. I just knew some greetings and numbers. I really began to learn the language when I met my husband. That made me open the books and go, okay, I've got to be able to talk to this man. And
right, yeah.
Yeah, we got married after knowing each other for 2 weeks.
What?
Yes.
Whoa. Yeah. Huh. What, is there a reason, or were you just crazy in love?
We were just crazy in love.
It wasn't like a visa issue or something?
Nope.
Huh.
Not at all.
Wow. I guess you got to get to speak his language then.
Yes. Huh. I was like, okay, we've got to figure this out. I was on the main island of Tarawa, and we had a Peace Corps meeting, conference, and I had to get back to my island, and all of the planes were full, and all of the boats were full, because my island was having this huge festival. They had built an island meeting house. There were three villages on my island, and each village had its own meeting house, a maniaba. And so they built one for the entire island. So it was really, really big. And to celebrate that, they invited dancers and singers and musicians. They invited the president. So there was no chance of me getting a spot on the airplane. And the man that worked as a liaison in the Peace Corps office, he found out that there was a boat going to my island, and he said, she's small, she doesn't eat a lot, can I put her on the boat with you guys? And they said, sure, she can ride with us. And so I ended up riding on a boat with a troop of dancers. They were traditional dancers, and he was one of the traditional dancers.
Ah, okay.
Yes, and I was older than all of the kids. They were young, these young late teen dancers, and I was in my early 20s. And he's younger than I am. He was 18 at the time when we started dating. But I didn't know that. And he didn't know his birthday either. We didn't know the birthday until we went to the offices of deaths, births, and marriages.
Yeah.
And that's when we had to find his birthday that was handwritten inside the book of births.
Oh. So it's not a priority for them?
No. His mother said, I think it was 1975.
Oh, he didn't even know the year?
No. So we had to go and flip through the pages of the book until we found his mom's name and his name entered in the book.
Oh, at least they wrote it down at the time.
We looked in 75 and it wasn't there. We looked in 76 and it wasn't there. And we found it in 77. But by then I was already hooked.
Oh, so he kept getting younger and younger as he flipped through this book.
Yes, his age kept going down and
like,
down.
If we hit 1980, we're going to have to break up.
Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
Too young. But yeah, but we got married after 2 weeks.
Wow, it's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And how much longer did you live on the island?
Not too much longer after we got married, but I was there almost 3 years total. Hmm. I didn't meet him until my tour was almost over.
Oh, okay. Now, is Peace Corps, is that normally 2 years?
Yes.
And you can just sign up for another year?
You can. I extended a little bit of time to help train the new Peace Corps volunteers that were coming in. But they don't let you do Peace Corps volunteering for more than 5 years. Hmm. Because they want you to go and serve and then go back home and take with you those great experiences to help you enrich whatever environment you're working in when you go back to the States.
Makes sense.
Huh. Part of it is to spread that knowledge of worldliness back into the States.
Okay. And other volunteers I've met, I think I remember them telling me that you select, when you figure out where you want to go, you select like a part of the world and not a country. So that you just, or what's the part of the world that you selected?
Asia.
Oh, it's all of Asia. Oh, wow.
Well, since I was raised in Southeast Asia, I wanted to head back in that area. But I basically said, I'll go anywhere. Oh. And my father said, anywhere but Africa. He was worried about me going to Africa and the sicknesses. He was hesitant. So I ended up in Asia.
Oh. But does Asia, according to this list, does that include like Israel and Turkey?
Well, that would be more Middle East.
Middle East. So that's okay. So at least it's narrowed down a little bit.
But yeah. But I said I would be willing to go anywhere.
Oh. And you just...
And then popped up Kiribati, and I was like, where's that?
Yeah.
So I had to research it and figure it out. And I thought I knew my geography pretty well, but...
Yeah.
Nope.
Right. Well, that's a pretty obscure one.
Yeah.
I remember I was in Guyana in South America, and I met a Peace Corps worker there in this little remote village. And when he heard he was going to Guyana, he thought he was going to Africa.
Ah.
But there's a country called Guinea in Africa, and he just thought that's what it was. Yeah, but no, Guyana, South America. Strange how like these random like almost flip of a coin things can change the course of your life. Yeah, in so many ways.
Yeah, it was an adventure. It was hard, but it was good. It did make me stronger, and it helped me realize that, you know, somebody's got my back, and life's just gonna keep going on, and there's a new adventure around the next corner, and you can do anything you really set your mind through, and you can survive a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot you can push through to the other side.
Yeah, for sure. Travel's definitely taught me that in general. Like, you don't sweat the small stuff once you've been through some bigger things. Yeah, and I'm sure you had plenty of stuff happen in such a remote place.
Yeah, it was hard and it was isolating. But
well worth it.
You choose, yes.
Yeah.
But deep inside you have to choose. You have to choose your joy. And if you choose it and say, you know, I'm just going to do this and I'm going to be happy and things are going to be okay, then it is.
All right, so it all works out.
It all works
somehow.
Out.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up right there. So thanks for coming on the show, Monica.
Oh, no problem. Awesome. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been an awesome time talking. I learned a lot about you. And we'll see everybody next time.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.